Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, episode number 191. My name's Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. On today's episode, we're going to be talking with the one and only Matt Bromley about some cutting-edge intel coming out of the Lima Charlie community Slack channel. It's another week, another set of bad actors, malicious files, and compromised systems. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some of the cutting-edge intel being shared by our awesome community in the Lima Charlie Slack channel, and a huge thank you to all those folks that take the time to share their knowledge with the rest of us. If you enjoy listening in on these intel chats and aren't in our community Slack channel yet, then you should join the conversation. Much more information than we can share on this show is being shared there, and you will get it in real time. You can join the Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. And as always, for these chats, I'm joined by the one and only Matt Bromley. How are you doing today, sir?
Chris, what's going on, my good friend? I am doing well. I can't complain. It is nearly end of January. We are almost 1 month into this crazy year known as 2025. Just when you thought things couldn't get any crazier, here we are, a couple weeks into a brand new U.S. administration. Every single day, there's a new AI model that can either raise stock prices or tank the market. And, for the rest of us, we just want to find some eggs. And all these things happening in the same 24-hour period can make it a very interesting day. But other than that, I'm doing well.
Yeah, I used to think it was a wild time to be alive because I couldn't give my kids advice on how to plan for the next 10, 20 years. Now I'm shortening that to 6 to 12 months.
10 minutes.
Yeah, 10 minutes.
Guys, we're going to go to the store. I don't know what we're going to find there or what we can afford to get. So just an FYI, it might be an interesting night tonight. Although I will say, if anyone out there has ever tried, I've been doing some reading lately on like World War II budget style food choices and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot you can do with spam. Just saying, like there's a, and I'm not being sarcastic or being somewhat mean here. There are some crazy things that you can do with spam, not just Masubi, everyone. There's some cool stuff you can make. So I'm, Chris, I'm actually digging back through the pantry a little bit and being like, what else can I make here with some of these things?
Yeah. And I encourage everybody to get some kind of garden going. I do that for fun and meditative purposes, but it's also in the back of my mind that, hey, one day this might be where a bunch of my food comes from. Out of necessity.
I'm going to say, as someone who over the years has watched Chris's garden come to life, the man can grow garlic. Yeah. I will tell you that much. Or garlic really likes whatever Chris puts in the soil. One of the two things.
Yeah, maybe I'll start sending cloves of garlic out with the t-shirts.
You're definitely not ever going to be friends with vampires. I'll tell you that much.
There you go. All right. I'm sure people are sick of listening to us. Let's get to the good stuff. Luma Stealer or Luma Stealer, an information stealing malware, has been observed using new evasion techniques to avoid detection. Researchers at Netskope found that recent versions of Luma Stealer now use fake CAPTCHAs as part of their infection chain. This tactic is designed to make malware appear more legitimate while also acting as a barrier against automated security scans. The fake CAPTCHAs require user interaction, preventing sandboxes and automated analysis tools from progressing past the initial infection stage. Attackers are leveraging this technique to distribute the malware via phishing emails and malicious websites. This sure feels like the Uno reverse card, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, a little bit here. So first off, I always like to give credit where credit's due. Hats off to the folks at Netskope for a really cool blog post, actually. Also, really nice color scheme. Makes it really easy to read, you know? But we want to focus more on, you know, we've talked, at length, certain pieces of malware and certain threat actors and the way that they try to evade detections or at least get past some of those initial automated analysis scans and whatnot. I think this is a pretty novel, unique way utilizing fake CAPTCHAs. And what you're doing there is you're kind of forcing a user-based layer where a user has to interact with it. And it's a great way to basically be like, am I in an automated system or not? Right? Because a CAPTCHA solver is likely not going to be dropped into like a malware sandbox or some sort of analysis tool that way. I do want to drop a quick note, though, that for anyone who's curious, and definitely check out the URL for this particular post in the show notes. But, you know, the CAPTCHA is actually the first step, if you will, of a 11 step infection process. The CAPTCHA URL is actually the one that kicks that off. And then there's multiple interactions with the remote server in place. There's use of HTA files, use of PowerShell commands and script execution and things like that. I think, Chris, you're going to cover some of the more technical details in a moment here. However, what I find interesting here for kind of everyone listening is once you get past that fake CAPTCHA URL, in my opinion, it gets really noisy after that, right? And one of the things we've talked about from a detection perspective is where is the most noise being created? And is that an appropriate place for me to detect and to look for this piece of malware? And I would say in this case right here, like there is so much noise being generated after the CAPTCHA is solved that you can implement some really solid detections in here, actually. One of the other things that I found unique is that and I'm reading directly from the blog here, the infection chain includes a step where attackers ask the victim to execute a command from their clipboard using Windows Run. And I think this is another really interesting technique, again, kind of forcing that user interaction side of it, which can also be used to, I'm not going to say evade defenses, but more like evade automated analysis techniques and things like that.
Yeah, it makes it look more legitimate, right?
It does. I think it prevents an automated system from actually stepping through and running through it. So it'll probably get a clean bill of health, or it will get a could not analyze clean bill of health, which in some folks' mind can be regarded as the same thing. So interesting technique from the adversaries here. Chris, you know, I always like to reflect on these adversarial moments. Some point somewhere there was a strategy meeting. Maybe it was over lunch or a coffee, who knows? And someone was like, dude, what if we put CAPTCHAs in place? And they're like, no, the last thing we want is user interaction. And they were like, well, these sandboxes keep beating us down. Let's insert some CAPTCHAs. And sure enough, they did. And it works.
Yeah. And phishing is a great way to deliver this kind of thing.
That's right. Phishing and Discord, of all places.
Yeah, Discord. I hear that a lot, actually. So once a victim interacts with a fake CAPTCHA, the malware executes its payload, which is designed to steal credentials, session tokens, and other sensitive information from the infected system. Luma Stealer also includes additional evasion techniques, such as encrypted communication with its command and control servers, and the ability to detect debugging environments. These capabilities make it more difficult for security researchers to analyze and mitigate the threat. The adoption of fake CAPTCHAs highlights a growing trend where attackers use social engineering not just to gain initial access, but also to bypass automated security defenses. Security teams are advised to educate users on recognizing suspicious CAPTCHAs and implement behavior-based detection strategies to identify anomalies in web interactions and authentication requests. I'm just curious, what's a suspicious CAPTCHA?
Yeah, I think it's a CAPTCHA that's out of place.
Right. Yeah, just your general, does this make sense that somebody's asking me to do this, not the actual CAPTCHA? Yeah.
Yeah, would I expect to be getting a CAPTCHA right now kind of thing? I would argue it's probably in the same vein as like a suspicious MFA, you know, like all of a sudden you get a code. And I love the whole like the training that's given with those, which is, you know, if you did not request this code, you can just ignore it. And I'm like, isn't someone trying to get in though? Like,
yeah, contact your security team.
Yeah, yeah. I guess everyone here, the big takeaway for user education is watch out for suspicious CAPTCHAs. I think this is going to be tough for anybody who's used to doing CAPTCHAs quite frequently, but I would have to argue as well that I don't know, and Chris, I haven't seen them in action here, but I'm not sure if the CAPTCHAs that the attackers are creating are as useful as the ones that are provided by like Google authentication and stuff like that. You know, I mean, I don't think the attackers are going to ask me which of these 20 pictures have bicycles in them, but maybe they do. Who knows? Maybe they do. I feel like it's more of a homegrown kind of library, though.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, next up, we got one from researchers at CloudSec who have uncovered a Trojanized version of the XWorm remote access Trojan builder that is being secretly distributed among cybercriminals. Threat actors seeking to use XWorm for their own malicious campaigns are unknowingly downloading a compromised version that includes a hidden backdoor. This backdoor allows the original distributor to gain control over any malware generated using the Trojanized builder. Essentially, cybercriminals exploiting XWorm are themselves being exploited by another threat actor. This case highlights an increasing trend where attackers turn on each other, embedding hidden malware in tools meant for cybercrime. I don't know. I think this is kind of great.
Depends on who's holding that master key.
You're right.
You know what I mean? This sounds like it could be a really good state intel run operation where you're like, we're going to get inside everyone's malware and just take them all over and stuff. The flip side of that is, I mean, who knows who's getting access to all these things? For anyone who's listening, CloudSec, CloudSEK is the site here. This is another hat tip towards a really well-written blog, really, really well thought out. Lots of links in this too. Like they provide links to all sorts of different GitHub repositories containing infection kits and stuff like that, which I was like, okay, I'm glad to have this. And there's even links towards Telegram channels. So there's a lot of exposure that happens in here, including a link, Chris, I don't know if you saw this one, to a video on a site called sinister.ly, which I found pretty interesting.
I did not see that one.
Sinisterly videos, but nonetheless, I will just kind of roll it back and say, in cases like this, you know, I'm not going to offer malware authors or exploit kit authors or Trojan authors any advice like, hey, check your source code. You know, that's not for you. Yeah. Those are for legitimate people doing things. But I guess where I'm a little more concerned here is, who is it that's actually holding the keys, or who is it that's actually holding this behind the scenes, you know?
Right. I wasn't saying it's great that some master criminal has the whole network.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course.
But
of
I like the fact that there's some distrust and anxiety brewing amongst the actors themselves.
Yeah, that's how it feels.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. But I think it just goes to show that, like, Chris, when I read this one, my immediate takeaway from this was, we've talked, I'd say, at great length on this show about how each kind of little corner and market of the whole kind of adversarial life cycle has become its own business. So that idea of, like, malware as a service. I mean, one time we talked about obfuscation as a service, but malware as a service. And then someone found a way to backdoor even that. So, like, even though this market, this whole entire industry has been segmented and broken up into as a service, each one of those little individual things is itself a target, you know? To me, it creates this ecosystem. It gives it even more complexity and makes it even more interesting, I think. But that being said, you know, I guess if you're a threat actor out there and you're listening to Chris and I for solid advice on your future life changes towards a more legitimate role in life, one of the things I'd offer you to do is to stop writing malware, number one. Number two, check your source code, see where it's coming from. You never know. You might be getting pwned by someone who themselves likes to pwn.
Yeah. Okay, so once a cyber criminal generates an XWORM payload using the Trojanized Builder, the backdoor ensures that the payload reports back to the original distributor, allowing them to monitor and potentially control infected machines. This secondary compromise poses additional risks, as multiple threat actors could have access to the same infected system, leading to unpredictable consequences. CloudSec's analysis indicates that this tactic is not only a betrayal within cybercriminal networks, but also a strategic move to consolidate power among certain groups. Security teams are advised to monitor for XWORM-related activity and ensure that any detections of this malware consider the possibility of multiple threat actors operating on the same compromised device. I think we've seen this before in areas in the world where there's a lot of nation state actors running, you know, two or three infections on the same machine.
Yeah, as always, right? I think some of the top victim countries they identified here were Russia, India, USA, Ukraine, and Turkey. But I think those are victims of the XWORM rot, not the actual, like, distribution thing behind the scenes. But nonetheless, I think this is a pretty interesting take of, like, watch out where your code comes from, I guess. Maybe universal advice for programmers everywhere, you know, despite what it is that you're building.
Threat actors included.
Yeah, threat actors included. You get a free piece of advice on this one, folks. Usually we're talking about how to shut you down. Now we're giving you some helpful advice here. But I do want to give a little bit of credit, CloudSEK, CloudSec. They do provide some awesome mitigation and detection options at the end of this, including some IOCs. If you're someone who's kind of in a parameter of being able to implement defenses or mitigations like this, I would definitely put them in place. There's some really good ones listed in here too. It's not just like, you know, watch out for the malware and stuff. It actually does talk about things you can do from an EDR perspective, how to watch out for Telegram API calls, which are likely non-standard inside a lot of organizations. So I think there's good things to lean on here.
Awesome. Okay, so next up, a recent disclosure by security researcher Zach Latta, I hope I'm saying your name right, highlights how the Washington State Department of Transport, or WSDOT, inadvertently exposed sensitive server credentials on its public website. The credentials were found embedded in JavaScript code, potentially allowing unauthorized access to critical systems. This type of exposure is a common yet serious security oversight, as it can enable attackers to access backend services, manipulate data, or launch further attacks on connected infrastructure. The issue underscores the risks associated with improper handling of secrets and front-end code and the need for rigorous security audits. Yes, folks, please use your .env file or whatever equivalent there is in front-end systems. It's 2025 and this shouldn't even be a thing.
You actually took the words right out of my mouth, Chris. I was going to say, this is something that shouldn't be happening either. Let's please not be hard coding things inside of our JavaScript and then shipping them out publicly and things like that. Huge call out. You know, I do think, like, this is something that still happens quite a bit. For anyone who's curious about this one, this link that we'll be providing for this one right here is actually pretty interesting. There's some interesting insight into what this researcher, Zach Latta, has unfolded and kind of what he's found and things like that. So some really cool kind of takeaways in what Zach is doing there. But I would like to kind of call point to really like the most important takeaway here, which is please, 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 please do not embed, you know, do not put hard-coded credentials inside of JavaScript and publicly ship them. Do not have those things out there. It's got to be a best development practice, but it's got to be the default development practice as well. We can't be doing this anymore. Y'all can see that this can get way too crazy. It can be way too much of an issue if someone gets a hold of them or the wrong person gets a hold of them. You know, we're lucky in this case that we're dealing with a security researcher and stuff like that. But if it's the wrong threat actor, who knows what could happen?
Yeah, I'm actually surprised there isn't some kind of automated service in GitHub or something like that. Well, that'll throw up a flag if it sees something like that being committed. I know we had a customer at Lima Charlie way back in the day that built some kind of pipeline in GitHub to check for, I think it was for licensing, to make sure they weren't incorporating licensing into their builds, but I think it could be used for credentials pretty easily.
So this is, you know, what's funny, a couple weeks ago, Chris, I was given a workshop and I might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but we had a discussion about like when vulnerabilities and things come out in the cloud, do cloud providers, first off, have the insight to just automatically patch them? And then do they have the responsibility to do so? And I think the same could be asked of GitHub as well, which is, hey, GitHub, if you see that there's, you know, hard-coded credentials being pushed through, why don't you stop that from happening? And it's like, well, they're not really in the business of monitoring and reading code.
Although they're training their AI on it.
Exactly, yeah. I was about to say, like, they are still using it just for their own purposes, right?
Yeah, they are reading it. They're just not in that way.
Yeah. No, an autonomous LLM is reading it. Right. So, but my point is very similar to the way a cloud provider isn't going to be like, hey, looks like you got some sensitive data inside of that S3 bucket. Might not want to put that there, buddy. Right. I think GitHub's like, well, you committed the code. I'm assuming you have development practices in place that would stop you from committing something critical. So,
and I'm sure as soon as they put any kind of potential stop in there, there's a liability grows because now they're giving people the assurance that,
of course, well, GitHub allowed me to commit. So it must be legitimate, you know?
Oh, man. All right.
It never ends, sir.
I thought I was going to get happier by the end of this episode, but it just...
I know, right?
All right. Last one up. We have a critical authentication bypass vulnerability noted as CVE-2024-21762. And drumroll, please, in Fortinet's 40OS. And it's been actively exploited in the wild, allowing attackers to execute arbitrary code and or gain unauthorized access to affected systems. This vulnerability affects multiple versions of FortiOS and stems from an issue in the SSL VPN component, which can be exploited remotely without authentication. Fortinet has released security patches addressing the flaw and has urged organizations to apply them immediately. Given the widespread use of Fortinet products in enterprise and government networks, the exploitation of this vulnerability poses a significant security risk. And I know when we went through the notes before the show today, Matt, you were like, oh, didn't we cover this last week? No, we did not. Last week, it was FortiGate. This is FortiOS. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Are they the same builder, though? Yeah. Right? Fortinet, I think. Fortinet, can we, like, shore up some of these development processes? Maybe? CVSS score of 9.6.
Oof.
On this one. Oof, my goodness. Yeah, interesting. Interesting on this one right here. I think Chris is going to talk about like the real groundbreaking thing in just a moment here, right? But folks, sorry, but this just goes down the line of once again, like, let's get some secure development processes in place. And I'm not a developer. I'm not saying it's easy to write code for firewalls, but like when the same vendors keep showing up again and again and again, you got to make you wonder, like someone somewhere do a code audit and lock some of these things down. You know, one of the things that is, of course, needs to be kept in mind here, Chris, and I remember reading through this one. There is a POC exploit that has been published, but if I'm not mistaken, it's actually leveraging the JS console feature. And I feel like I've run into this term a lot, where I feel like I've like the console and the JavaScript around the console is usually where some of the most common vulnerabilities are introduced. I just want to remind folks, like, maybe build these things with a little more care and concern or lock them down a little bit more, right? Attackers were targeting the management interfaces of FortiGate firewalls, leveraging the JS console feature. And it's kind of like, I hate to say we're running into the same place again and again. So maybe, you know, a better third-party library or something needs to be leveraged in order to make more sense of this here. But nonetheless, if you're in that Fortinet camp, make sure you're patching, patching, patching. And if I was you, I would just keep that patch button right under your fingertip. You might need it again soon.
It's interesting you mentioned the JS console because, yeah, I can see how that would be really vulnerable. You know, they're trying to make a web interface using JavaScript, which you can inherit from everything. The arrays can be anything you want mixed together. It's a very loose language. And then you're trying to build a portal into the backend system there. I can just see there's probably tons of opportunity for shenanigans.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing about it too is in reading through it there, or in kind of just kind of going through it, it's a UI, it's a GUI that's built to help issue CLI commands and stuff like that. And I think, like, all right, if that's the sole intention and purpose of it, you got to remember there are inherent permissions, Chris, that come with that. Because if you want to issue commands from a UI, you need to kind of transfer those permissions through. And maybe there's a safer, a more reliable way to do that.
Yeah. So threat actors exploiting this flaw are able to gain full control over vulnerable systems, enabling data theft, network compromise, and lateral movement within the organization's infrastructure. The vulnerability has been added to CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities, or KEV catalog, which, Matt, you said is the triumph of all the Trump. I don't want to use the word Trump. It's the top of all the ones that you should be concerned about.
That's the where you should now care meter.
Yes. So security teams should prioritize patching affected FortiOS versions and monitor network traffic for signs of exploitation. Additionally, disabling the SSL VPN feature, if not in use, and implementing network segmentation, blah, blah, blah. I feel like this is the same thing all the time. The incident underscores the importance of timely patch management, particularly for perimeter defense systems like Fortinet security appliances.
Always, always, always.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like this one just, we kept getting more depressed towards the end of the episode.
Yeah. This one goes down the road of like secure software development. Maybe don't put stuff inside of, you know, maybe don't put credentials inside of JavaScript. And no, look at that. Fortinet makes another appearance on this one.
I know we're not going to do the hacker histories anymore, but maybe, like, I'd be interested to know about the history of Fortinet.
How the company came about, or
how did they come to be so prevalent, and why do they have so many problems? Is it simply just because they face the internet, or is there some historical debt there that hasn't been paid off?
I'll be honest with you. I try not to, and I'm not saying you're doing this. This is more like my answer to that question, right? I try not to accuse developers of too much, because I think what happens is there's a lot of legacy code that gets left in, and it's kind of like, well, the UI works, so why not? And it just kind of ships with that. And then when you have a lot of, like, I think network hardware based companies, sometimes the focus tends to be on, like, the network, the hardware side of it. You know, not saying that Fortinet doesn't care about software whatsoever, but I think that they've definitely shifted maybe their priorities onto, like, the hardware side of things. Like, let's make sure we can support the most modern networks, because we're competing with Palo Alto and Checkpoint and Cisco and whatnot, you know. And then I just pulled this up randomly as we're talking about it as well. Fortinet has seen a 69% growth in their stock price over, as of Monday, January 27th, 2025. Over the trailing 6 months, their stock has surged 69%. So they're clearly doing well.
That's wild.
Yeah, they're clearly doing well. And if someone were to come to you and be like, hey, you know, just an FYI, like, your software is kind of vulnerable, they're like, yeah, okay, see ya. You know?
I've had somebody tell me before that at a certain point, a company's main product becomes its stock. And maybe that's what happened here. I'm not sure.
Well, the goal of any company is to return value to its shareholders, right? That's what you get taught in business school. So maybe that's what they're working on. But Chris, I think it's honestly a lot of legacy holdover code. And when you go through a series of, like, mergers and acquisitions and things like that, and then you try to adopt yourself to new technologies, some of your older legacy code doesn't get necessarily left behind, but it doesn't receive the same type of software care that you'd expect to see.
Sure. And there might be restrictions on what kind of code can run on the old hardware.
And exactly. And then not for nothing too, maybe the final little part I'll add in here is, given kind of the interesting rocky landscape we've had when it comes to, like, sanctions and all sorts of discussions put around vulnerabilities and responsibilities and who's vulnerable for this and whatnot, it might honestly just be up to, you know, all right, well, if it's vulnerable, it's vulnerable. Just ship it. We'll patch it later on. And that's it.
Ship it.
Ship it. We'll fix it later.
All right. Well, that brings us to another end of a cheery podcast episode full of hope and light.
As always, we're here to deliver the news. No matter what part of shade or sunlight the news is on, we're here to deliver it.
So maybe next week we'll try and find some articles about people getting thrown in jail. Cheer things up a little.
Let's do that. Well, we did talk about the malware backdoors being backdoored themselves.
Yes, that was pretty good.
That's where we'll find our pieces.
I did avoid talking about the Silk Road guy being pardoned because...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes you just got to let your Bitcoin millionaires off the hook. You never know.
Maybe light a few Bitcoins.
Yeah, right?
Anyway, probably a good time to sign off. Matt, it's always a pleasure, sir. I had a lot of fun today, despite the downward spiral of hope.
Likewise. Likewise, Chris. I will talk to you again soon next week.
Okay. Take care, sir.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
And that concludes this episode of the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas for future topics, please send an email to defenders@limacharlie.io. You can access the intel we talk about on the show in real time and join the conversation on the Lima Charlie Community Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with someone or leaving a rating or review. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you on the next episode.